Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about the Clery Act and what UMD and other Minnesota colleges and universities are doing to keep students safe from sexual assault on campus and the reporting and training they're requiring of faculty, staff, and students to help them meet that goal. Our guests in the studio this evening are Lieutenant Sean Hulls, who is a police officer here on campus and the UMD Clery Act coordinator, and Dr. Lisa Irwin, UMD Vice Chancellor for Student Life, Dean of Students, and she also worked on the Clery Act on a national level. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Lisa, let's start with the Clery Act. It's Clery, C-L-E-R-Y. Can you tell us a little bit about the Clery Act?
The Clery Act is named after Jean Clery, and Jean Clery was a 19-year-old freshman who attended Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. And Jean was brutally raped and murdered in her college dorm back in 1986. And her parents looked into some of the crime history and actually started lobbying to the Pennsylvania state government and to enact safety and disclosures on college campuses. And so it started when they did a little history and a little digging, they found that there were some serious crimes that had occurred in previous years at Lehigh University. And so the Clerys went to the state of Pennsylvania and got a sponsorship with some legislatures and started a campus safety act at a state level, which eventually led to a federal act in 1990, I believe. President Bush signed it into act in 1990. And the act has just grown and changed over the years to what is today's Clery Act.
So I got involved because in 2013, as part of the Violence Against Women Act, the Clery Act was amended to provide some greater clarity around issues of sexual assault, in particular prevention, awareness, and then an improved response when someone reports.
Not to equate the crimes by any means, but we don't on the university campus institute a lot of policies and procedures trying to keep people from stealing cars, for example. Mm-hmm. Does it seem as though it might be a little bit outside the scope of what a university does or should do?
I think it's within scope, Lisa, and that's because what we know about sexual assault on campus paints a picture that's different from the other example that you gave, which is car thefts or other kinds of things. There are some studies that say that 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted over their lifetime. And 90% of the women who are sexually assaulted in college know their attacker. So the incidence of this particular crime is significant and severe. In addition, the impacts on someone who's sexually assaulted are so significant and so life-changing. The trauma, the inability to focus on your studies, all of those things make this issue one of particular significance to college campuses. The other thing I would say is, while I would never try to blame a victim for anything like this that happens to them, we know that alcohol is very frequently associated with these issues. And so college campuses and their relationship to alcohol use means that this problem is more severe and very difficult to manage.
Let's talk about some of the changes in this act, because one of the changes requires institutions to also record incidents of dating violence or domestic violence or stalking in addition to sexual assault. What was the idea behind adding those into the scope of the act?
Well, again, there was a viewpoint that these kinds of issues are often related and often a part of the college experience that really derails a student for whom this happens. So there was a comprehensive effort to really look at all of those issues in one act. I would say that the stalking issue in particular has been very complicated by social media. So there was a lot of discussion in the negotiated rulemaking committee about cyber stalking and what that means and what that looks like. And there's a high incidence of that across our country. And so there was a particular focus on that kind of stalking.
Adding gender identity and national origin as a couple of two new categories of bias that can serve as the basis for the determination of a hate crime. Does this have to do with hate crimes against gay, lesbian, transgender people, or the idea that someone is going to go after you because you're a woman?
I think it's more related to an increased awareness and interest in protecting the rights of LGBT people. And in most federal legislation, because LGBT people don't have discrimination protection, there was a concerted effort in this act to make sure that this was called out so that the problem could be really understood in more fully, and really all people, all college students would be protected.
As we talk about these protections and reportings and keeping people safe, are we talking about men and women?
Absolutely we are. In fact, one of the negotiated rulemakers, there were two students on the negotiated rulemaking committee, and one was a young man who was a student on the East Coast who had been sexually assaulted. And so his perspective was really, really informative for the committee to understand that it's a more fully experienced problem than just a problem for women. Clearly, more women are assaulted than men. There's no disputing that those facts. But to sort of discount those experiences of men who are sexually assaulted is a mistake. And so this legislation and the follow-up regulations really took that into account. And again, this young man's name is John Kelly, and he was a powerful influence on the committee to understand the problem really fully.
Talking about the range of protective measures that an institution may offer following a report of dating violence or domestic violence or sexual assault or stalking, what sorts of protective measures does UMD have in place?
We have been very creative in working with students who make complaints to figure out what kinds of things they need. So our range of measures includes things like moving residence halls, either the complainant or the reporter person that's accused moving. We've moved classes so that they didn't have to see each other in classes. We've actually changed routes of walking to classes so that the two wouldn't encounter one another. We have made arrangements for one of the two to have an online version of a class. We have limited their time in the cafeteria to certain hours of the day so that they don't see one another. So we have a lot of experience in supporting students in this way. And again, we get very creative so that we're really meeting the needs of the person who made the report. We also establish a no contact order. So when a report comes in, one of the first things we say to both individuals is you are not to contact one another. And that includes social media, texting, and other things. Because we have found that their way of being is so tied to often social media and so forth that we need to give this instruction. And so that helps really protect both individuals. We also work with our UMD PD colleagues to help the students arrange for a protective order through the courts. And maybe, Sean, you'd want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, if the perpetrator would happen to not be a student, you know, the police department, we will work with the victim and help them through court orders or protection orders, no contact orders. So that's something that our officers are trained in, and, you know, we want to help the victim as much as possible.
What if someone makes an accusation against someone else? They say, so-and-so has been stalking me. In that instance, the guilt or innocence of the perpetrator hasn't been established yet. How do you proceed at that point?
Well, again, we would work with both individuals to say, stop contact. That doesn't assume that anybody is responsible for a policy violation or not. It just simply says, no more contact. And then we will work with the person who made the complaint to figure out what they need in order to feel safe. And what we would then arrange in terms of protective measures isn't punitive to the person to whom they're reporting about. Rather, it just really establishes a way to keep them apart and keep them not in contact. So you're absolutely right. No assumption about a policy violation is made until there's an investigation and evidence is collected and folks are interviewed and we have a very clear picture of what went on. And then, and only then, might we move forward with a charge under a policy violation. But in the meanwhile, we're taking measures that are not punitive but help people separate.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the Clery Act and what UMD and other Minnesota colleges and universities are doing to keep students safe from sexual assault on campus. Our guests this evening, Lieutenant Sean Hulls, the UMD Clery Act Coordinator, and Dr. Lisa Irwin, Vice Chancellor for Student Life at UMD, the Dean of Students, and she has worked on the Clery Act on a national level.
In a related note, there's another piece of legislation, which is Title IX. You've probably heard of Title IX of the Education Amendments. That happened in 1972. And over the years, the Department of Education has clarified very, very strongly that sexual harassment and sexual assault are forms of sex discrimination, which Title IX prohibits. So I love the elegance and beauty of that law in the guidance, because they say very simply, an institution's job is to stop the behavior, address its effects, and prevent its reoccurrence. So when we are doing these protective measures that are required under Clery, we're also meeting an obligation under Title IX, which is to stop the behavior, which if you've got folks separated, the chances that it's stopping are very much improved. Addressing the effects, which is helping that person reporting feel safe, get help, and then prevent its reoccurrence is the disciplinary part that may or may not happen. It's conceivable that someone who reports in the end doesn't want to go through a full-blown disciplinary proceeding. And we really try to respect that choice when a person reports. So doing the protective measures addresses part of the issue without forcing them to go into a police report or to a disciplinary hearing.
There are going to be a lot of trainings, and there's going to be some additional reporting information, trainings of students, trainings of faculty and staff that are coming up. Talk about that and how the entire UMD community, not just maybe a small faction of student life or the police department, needs to get involved to help keep students safe.
Well, the Clery amendments in 2013 sort of segmented the training requirement into two pieces. One is you must provide prevention and awareness training to your new students and your new employees. And so UMD has tackled that by instituting a module called Haven, and our partner is EverFi, a national organization. And so all of our incoming freshmen and transfer students are required to complete this module, which is, again, it's an educational module that helps students think about prevention and about bystander intervention and other concepts, other concepts that are really central to deepening an understanding of sexual assault and preventing it. Then for new employees, a new employee piece is also being developed by HR and Equal Opportunity, Human Resources and Equal Opportunity for a brand new employee so that they can get a sense of what happens at UMD and what their role is. And then the other portion is ongoing education, and we just have a host of programs that we're doing for students, beginning with Bulldog Welcome Week and all year round. The Women's Resources and Action Center is doing programming. The bystander intervention program is called Got Your Back UMD, and it runs out of health services who've trained over 2,000 students on techniques of bystander intervention, which is essentially watching out for one another. So if you see a friend who seems to be in a situation that isn't going to be safe, how do you intervene? And does some teaching and coaching around how that works. So I'm really proud of UMD and where we are. For employees, we have done to date 9 sessions over the fall and spring semesters that acquaint employees with what their role is in terms of this difficult issue. The University of Minnesota policy is very clear. Everybody has a role to play. And that's because this issue is so serious that to have it go not shared, it does not do anything to solve the problem. So if you're a supervisor and advisor, you need to call either the Title IX coordinator in human resources or the Title IX coordinator in student conduct. And if you're not one of those, you can either tell your supervisor who can make that call for you or call yourself. And so we've been asked a lot, well, I think I should be able to keep that information confidential. And that's a really hard thing for advisors and folks that work very closely with students and develop very close relationships. But the standpoint of the university is that this issue is so difficult and so derailing, it was a great term that you used earlier, that we all have a role to at least share what's going on. Because again, in the end, we're not going to force a victim to go through a process they don't want to. But by having this information shared to a Title IX coordinator, we can ensure that they get the support and help that's available to them, either on campus or in the community.
It was explained to me that because I work with my student news team, I have interns and student volunteers that I work with, that if I am sitting in my office and we're having a schmooze and we're talking news and the conversation becomes personal and they share something like this with me, that I have to stop them and say, I have to report this. And I pondered that quite a bit. Would I be cutting off an opportunity for someone to unburden themselves, for someone to feel that they had found a safe person that they could talk to, and would they have a sense of betrayal if I, you know, either interrupted them and cut them off, or if I listened to them and said, oh, and by the way, what's the best way to respond?
I always say this. First, express concern. Say, I think you're about to tell me about something that was really difficult for you, and I want you to know, first and foremost, I'm so sorry this happened to you. I think to convey that care and that sense that you believe them is really, really important. And then I would go on to say, you know, we at the university take these issues really, really seriously. And so I want you to know that if you want to share this with me, I really have to share it on with someone else so that we can be sure you're supported at UMD. If you don't want me to do that, then I want to give you this list of confidential resources, and I'll walk you over if you want, so that I can connect you with somebody that you can totally unburden to, and then there will be no obligation for that person to report. So that might be counseling, and then there's the Women's Resource and Action Center, and then I have this bookmark on my desk with some other resources. So that's the way I've handled it, and over a 30-year career, Lisa, I've done this many, many times, and I found it to be effective. Again, and I would walk them.
We do have online reporting that is anonymous reporting. Mm-hmm. Is it appropriate to say, but you can make this report anonymously?
You certainly can offer that option. But again, part of the reason we want to connect them with a Title IX coordinator is that that person can really describe all of their options. And so at that point, they might say, I don't want to talk to you. The student might say, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to share any of this about this. The Title IX coordinator might say, you know what? Consider filing this anonymously. You can do that. So you can go to the police. Again, some of the regulations are now saying that we must give students all of their options. And so I think that's a great way of helping the student. But again, connecting them to somebody who's really trained in this will give them their full range of options. We really are forcing a conversation, and I fully understand that, and I understand also how that can feel not comfortable for a faculty or staff member, because we're sort of saying you have to do this, you have to make this report. But again, it's the most underreported crime on campus. We know that. And so how else do we begin to get people the support they need and provide them with their options unless we're sharing the information? So can't keep it confidential.
There is a bill before the Minnesota legislature to have this online reporting system, which could keep these reporting parties anonymous. Is that something that UMD already has in place? So we're already ahead of the curve on that?
We are. We have an online reporting form. And if this bill passes, we would strengthen the language at the beginning to make crystal clear how to report anonymously, which is essentially in the part of the form that asks for demographic information. You just put anonymous in every field. So absolutely, we have that. And actually, people have figured that out without us being crystal clear in our directions, and it happens all the time.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the Clery Act and what UMD and other Minnesota colleges and universities are doing to keep students safe from sexual assault on campus. Our guests this evening, Lieutenant Sean Holves, the UMD Clery Act Coordinator, and Dr. Lisa Irwin, Vice Chancellor for Student Life at UMD, the Dean of Students, and she has worked on the Clery Act on a national level. How do these conversations play out when you are dealing with real people and real situations?
Yeah, these can be very difficult conversations. You know, we know that it's a very traumatic situation. There's a lot of emotions involved. And as a police department, when we're investigating sexual assault in particular, we always use a victim-centered approach, you know. We're there to support the victim. We're there to listen to the victim's story. We're there to offer help and resources. You know, we're there to, we believe the victim unless we have evidence to believe otherwise. We're not there to make a determination. We're there to investigate the potential crime, and we're there as fact finders. We do a thorough investigation, and we complete a report and investigation, and we send it on to the court. And then that's up to the criminal justice system, you know, to determine if a crime was committed. So, you know, we always, our officers are well trained, you know, in the victim center approach, and we want them to always have, you know, the victim's well-being in mind throughout the process, because we understand that it's a very, very difficult process with a lot of emotions.
And I would add, it's such an amazing blessing to live in Duluth, Minnesota, and have PAVSA, the Program to Aid Victims of Sexual Assault, as a partner. So I've worked at 6 institutions, and this is the community where there has been the absolute best working relationship between a university, to include the UMDPD, the Student Life folks, the Women's Resource and Action Center, and PAVSA. And they are absolutely our partners. They do our training. So the reason Sean can say they're victim-centered and we can say that we have a victim-centered approach in the student conduct realm is that they're doing our training. They're helping us with language. They're helping us with the kinds of questioning that doesn't make a victim feel not believed or doubted. So that relationship, again, has been such an amazing gift. And I, if they're listening, I would like to say a hearty thank you to PAVSA. Candy Harshner and her team are really, really, really great folks.
So how often does it happen that someone reports anonymously or not in an effort to get somebody in trouble?
I have not seen it.
I have not.
So it makes a wonderful plot point, perhaps, mm-hmm. for a novel or a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not seeing it happening in real life.
No, that doesn't mean that in all cases a student who is accused is found responsible, because they are very difficult issues and very complex. But I have not seen a situation where there was a deliberate attempt to accuse with some malicious idea. The pain and the trauma that really are experienced by everybody involved in the situation, especially the victim, most especially the victim, is very compelling.
Sean, Scott Drulow is retiring at the end of the month, and there will be a search for a new chief of police here on campus. You're going to be the acting chief in the meantime. I was just fascinated to learn about what Lisa alluded to, all of the different partnerships that the UMD Police Department has. We've had conversations with Duluth Police Chief Gordon Ramsey about community policing, and it sounds like it's almost a community policing model here on campus. Talk about that a little bit.
It is, and it's a community effort. And, you know, the more help that we can have, the better. And like Lisa said, I just can't say enough good things about PAVSA and, you know, our own Women's and Resources and Action Center. And, you know, we're all in this together. We're all our team here at UMD. And, you know, we're all have the goal in mind in keeping our students safe and making sure that they have the resources and, you know, their well-being in mind, because ultimately they're here to get an education, and we're here also to keep them safe and support them. If you don't have safety, this can't be a learning environment. So we're all in this together. We have the same goal, and I just can't say enough about how important partnerships, relationships, and teamwork amongst all of us who have a stake at UMD, how important that is.
The relationship between the Duluth Police Department and the UMDPD is phenomenal. In addition, we count among our partners the county attorney. So we've done 2 meetings since I've come to UMD. I've been here 4 years, where we've had a big sit-down with the county attorney. And Mark Rubin comes himself. He's a phenomenal an advocate and a great partner in this work. And DPD, UMDPD, RAC, PAVSA, Student Conduct, and we all get in a room and talk about how things are working. And it's just, again, I've worked in a number of institutions, and it's really special here in Duluth.
Yeah, I don't think that cooperation exists throughout the country at all institutions like it does here at UMD and in Duluth in particular. So we have some great partnerships in place, and we continue to foster them. You know, you talked about Chief Drulow retiring. He's helped enhance those, and that's something, even in my interim, that I think will be in utmost of importance to me, to make sure that we keep and build upon those partnerships.
Lisa, you've alluded a couple of times to the length of time that you have been doing this work. Let's talk about where we are and where you see us moving in the future.
Well, I will say this. I am absolutely amazed and very proud of the way students have been involved in this conversation. So the reason that Title IX is now more closely adhered to and the reason the Clery Act amendments happened is because student activists on college campuses created a groundswell, a demand to have colleges take this more seriously and to do a better job at prevention and response. So I see that only continuing because these students have created organizations that after graduation, they're maintaining. And that's thrilling. That's a thrilling outcome for anybody who's an educator to see students learning about how to organize and how to have their voices heard and then to continue the conversation. So, I think the legislation will continue. There's two or three bills. You mentioned the one in Minnesota. There's also two or three at the national level. One of those would require each institution to do a campus climate sexual assault survey on campus climate so that institutions can get a better handle on the incidents of sexual assault and what kind of behaviors and what kind of attitudes students have about this. So this issue is here to stay, and I think colleges and universities will be about gaining more knowledge and information about what's really happening. Because, again, it's underreported. So we had, in the fall semester, 8 reports. So if we do a survey, which we're planning to a year from now, we'll have a much better sense of what it's really like on our campus. That's really exciting to me to have data from which you can make decisions and better present that prevention education from a place of knowledge. So I think the commitment's there. It's the commitment's there because of our students, and it's going to continue.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here at KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Lieutenant Sean Hulls, UMD's Clery Act Coordinator, and Dr. Lisa Irwin, UMD Vice Chancellor for Student Life, Dean of Students, and a contributor to the amendments of the Clery Act. Here on the UMD campus, April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Throughout the month, UMD's Women's Resources and Action Center and the North Central Windows Program will be holding art enrichment workshops. It's a chance for students, staff, and faculty and community members who've been victims of violence to use art as a healing tool in a safe setting. Throughout the month, there will be trainings in bystander intervention and self-defense, along with a series of programs on topics like relationship violence. It's everyone's business. A brown bag session on PAVSA, the program to aid victims of sexual assault, and another on Take Action Duluth, and a program for men to join women in preventing violence against women at parties called the Best Party Model. The Clothesline Project is a visual display of T-shirts made by survivors of violence and sexual assault to tell their stories. The Hunting Ground is an expose of the epidemic of sexual assaults on college campuses. Beautiful You, Love Your Body, the World, and Consent is a tabling area for information on sex education and consent. And the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Department is teaming up with RAC to present a mock rape trial based on actual events. These and other educational opportunities will be ongoing through the month of April here on the UMD campus. And you can find the complete list posted with this episode of Community Conversations on our website, kumd.org. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.